and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, 20,000 teachers across the state of North Carolina have gone on strike, shutting schools in 40 districts to cancel classes for more than a million students. In a familiar refrain, the teachers want better benefits and higher salaries, which have declined 9.4% in the past decade in real terms. Next, dramatic changes are underway in Malaysia as new Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad takes office. Police raided Mahathir's predecessor Najib Razak's home, and longtime opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim has been released from prison. Then President Trump and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin will meet with Chinese Vice Premier Liu He to discuss trade. The meetings are meant to prevent trade tensions from spiraling into a trade war, a possibility since the administration imposed sanctions on Chinese goods. And then a Ukrainian diplomat in Hamburg, Germany has been suspended after posting virulently anti-Semitic remarks on Facebook. Vasil Marushchinets wrote that Jews were responsible for World War II and ended the post with, quote, "death to the anti-fascists," unquote. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko condemned the remarks, but he recently signed into law a measure that glorifies Ukrainians who collaborated with the Nazis. And finally, the Senate yesterday passed a non-binding resolution nullifying the Federal Communications Commission's net neutrality rollback. The 52-47 vote is a symbolic blow to the FCC, but the net neutrality revocation remains on track to take effect next month. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to North Carolina and its teacher strike. 20,000 teachers across the state of North Carolina have gone on strike, shutting schools in 40 districts and canceling classes for more than 1 million students. In a familiar refrain, the teachers want better benefits and higher salaries, which have declined 9.4% in the past decade in real terms. We're joined from Washington by Liz Davis. She's president of the Washington Teachers Union, and she has taught in the D.C. public schools for 41 years. Liz, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back on today.
Liz, we've talked to you several times about teacher strikes in places like West Virginia and Arizona and Colorado and Kansas and Arkansas, et cetera, et cetera. Now, here we are again talking about a teacher strike in North Carolina. I don't remember so many statewide strikes happening in 1 year in my lifetime. Am I just not very observant, or is this a real movement that we're seeing here?
I believe it's a real movement. And, you know, ironically, we just completed the National Teacher Appreciation Week last week. And instead of appreciating teachers one day or 1 week every year, we need to pledge to make it a year-round event. The teachers in North Carolina, especially after reading this legislator Mark Brody's comments about the teachers, referring to them as thugs, it is unsettling. And, of course, some of the ramblings that he went on some online statement came after the county closed schools for the May 16th rally. But, you know, these teachers, and of course, Brody went on to suggest that the teachers could have done this without inconveniencing anyone. Protest without inconvenience. Can you imagine that? And I had to think, his reference to teachers as union thugs shows his disdain for and disrespect for teachers, especially teachers who dedicate their lives to teaching students, nurturing and supporting children. And I wonder if this is what Brody thought of his own teachers or the teachers of his own children.
I saw a very interesting quote today in one of the North Carolina newspapers, and it said that one of the things that North Carolinians really pride themselves on is the fact that even though they're a southern state, that they've always been very progressive when it came to public education. Well, the truth is that they're really not very progressive anymore where it comes to public education. Their teachers' salaries and benefits are ranked in the bottom tier of nationwide teachers' salary and benefits, and that really only hurts the children. So now they ask for better benefits, better pay, and frankly, better support inside the classroom, and they're denied. And so the only way they can make a change is to go on strike. The truth is they shouldn't have had to even go on strike.
And what gets me is, like, you know, when they talk about the teachers are causing inconvenience, well, it's very inconvenient not to be paid a living wage. It's very inconvenient not to have adequate benefits. It's very inconvenient not to have school supplies in the classroom. It's very inconvenient for the children. It's very inconvenient you know, the status quo is not convenient. And the only way the status quo changes is when people struggle.
That's
like
it.
Like Frederick Douglass said, if you want change, you have to struggle. Without struggle, no progress. Go ahead, Liz.
And legislators like Brody basically is trying to camouflage the fact that he does not believe what parents and teachers believe. And these protests across the country and the issues that the teachers are fighting for involve what kids need to be career and college ready. It's not about just pay raises. All of these work stoppages across the country, teachers demanding the same thing that parents and other members of the communities want for children, an investment and pride in public schools. Not a disinvestment and disrespect. These teachers want the same for their students as parents and the public want for students. They want basic supplies, as well as modern operational technology, class sizes small enough for individualized attention. They believe that every school should have the current and sufficient textbooks for all children. And what North Carolina is proposing, what the legislators there are proposing, is that for the school district to operate on 20th century supplies and resources. It's outrageous.
We are speaking with Liz Davis. She's here in Washington, D.C. She's the president of the Washington Teachers Union, and she's taught in the D.C. public schools for 41 years. We're talking about the new North Carolina teacher strike. So, Liz, tell me, as we look now to the end of the school year, are we looking at more teacher strikes elsewhere around the country? It seems to me to be only natural that other teachers who are facing these same hurdles are looking to places like North Carolina and Colorado and West Virginia and Arizona and saying, hey, this works, and the state legislatures aren't going to stand up for us, so we need to stand up for ourselves.
And teachers have been demanding these same resources for years, and it has not worked. So civil disobedience is the order of the day. This is what gets the legislators' attention, and of course, this is also what draws national attention to a lot of the under-resourced and underfunding that is happening across the nation for public education. And teachers basically know that they are the ones who are on the front lines. They are the ones who are actually going to have to lead this cause, because parents have attempted for years. We've talked about school budgets and how the federal government and local governments fund public education, how they basically have begun the process of defunding public education in order to grow privatization schemes, charters, and vouchers. And our public school teachers and parents are simply not going to stand for that. We want a public education system with schools of right that all children are welcome, where all children are welcome. And this is basically, educators have taken on the position that they are the leaders. They are basically the heroes that the public has been waiting for. Legislators are simply not going to do it. And this is what draws attention to the issues. This is what embarrasses legislators into doing the right thing, because trying to have humanistic conversations with them or dialogues to include the voices of teachers and parents hasn't worked. So this is a new order of the day.
And, you know, it's like every social movement that ever becomes a thing and really leads to profound change starts just like this. You heap abuse after abuse after abuse on people. You treat them like they're just, you know, chattel or something. You deprive them of the right to strike. And now we have the Supreme Court is about to hear the Janus case, stripping, you know, if the conservative right-wing majority mm-hmm. gets its way, stripping public sector workers completely of the right to actually have a strong union, a closed shop, taking all of that away. And under these circumstances, we go to red state areas that are already right-to-work areas. Meaning it's not legal to strike, and the unions have been historically weaker, but it's precisely in these areas that the people are fighting back. And thus, it's not really San Francisco, it's not Berkeley, it's not New York. It's like in these conservative areas where people are starting to change. It's just like what happens over and over and over again with social movements.
Oh, yes. And, you know, it's ironic that Brody would go on to cite teacher unions as teachers' greatest enemies. You know, one would think that a legislator in 2018 would have some historical memory about the civil and human rights gains in this country that were initiated by labor unions, especially for poor people and people of color. The work stoppages in West Virginia and Oklahoma and now in North Carolina were supported by teacher unions who saw the need to draw attention to the blatant underfunding of our public schools and disrespect for teachers. But this is a good place. When Brody and other legislators like him step out to speak against teachers, unions, the unions that represent working class America, they're basically giving us information. They're giving us a basis for our struggle. So Brody was right about one thing. The more than 13,500 teachers that he referred to as thugs, they are forced to be reckoned with because they bring a very special set of skills to this as effective advocates. They are experts, and they deal with fact-based arguments. Brody's claims that teachers' biggest legislative support comes from Republican legislators. So let's review what that support looks like. The funding for textbooks in North Carolina is down by 45% from peak levels. The funding for supplies and materials is down by 55% from peak levels. Funding for technology down by 59%. Textbooks, supplies, technology down 51%. And 5.3 fewer teachers per student compared to the pre-recession levels. So the per pupil funding, all of that is showing losses under the legislators, what he considers as having an interest in education. These are the facts that teachers are bringing to legislators in North Carolina and to the public. So we can't, you know, the diatribe that he's ranting on Facebook, let's look at the facts. And when we talk about North Carolina school system, which is supposed to be progressive, has been noted to be progressive. These are the facts. The teachers there are bringing it to the forefront and making it public knowledge that what legislators are saying is basically it needs to be fact-checked. And I'm happy to see that teachers are continuing with this movement. And yes, I do believe that this will continue across the nation because we are discovering that this is what works.
We have about 30 seconds left. I want to ask you really quickly about the teachers' unions. My parents were public school teachers in Pennsylvania. The unions were very strong in Pennsylvania, both the American Federation of Teachers and the National Education Association. But what about in places like North Carolina, these southern states or red states or so-called right-to-work states? Are these strikes helping the unions to expand into areas that they otherwise have been pushed out of?
Yes, it will. And of course, even though we have teachers, when you look at Texas, which is a right-to-work state, the organized teachers there are very strong. They have a voice. And they are learning how to deal directly with legislators, bypassing all of the in-between layers of bureaucracy. So yes, this is an opportunity for unions to organize. And it also is an opportunity for us to have conversations about the right to work or the right to work for less issue, because that has been a misnomer as well. And so we want to address that. But this is an opportune time to do it.
We were joined from Washington by Liz Davis. She is the president of the Washington Teachers Union, and she has taught in the D.C. public schools for 41 years. Liz, thanks for joining us. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Dramatic changes are underway in Malaysia as the new Prime Minister, Mahathir Mohamad, takes office. Police raided Mahathir's predecessor, Najib Razak's home, and longtime opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim has been released from prison. We're joined from Singapore by Niall Bowie. He's a writer and journalist with the Asia Times covering Singapore and Malaysia. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News producer and political analyst Walter Smolarek. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Niall, I'm only a casual observer of Malaysia, but even casual observers are amazed at the monumental changes that we've seen in Malaysia just over the last couple of days. Can you explain how things are playing out there?
Indeed, it's been pretty momentous. I guess the best place to sort of frame this story would be to go back to elections last week. So last week, the Malaysian opposition parties defeated the governing coalition for the first time ever. The Barisan Nasional, or BN, had been in power for 61 years. The opposition coalition, the Pakatan Harapan, now holds power at the federal level. So this change has been one of the most significant events in Malaysian history, and Malaysians have responded with jubilance and euphoria. So the new prime minister is Mahathir Mohamad. He was prime minister for 22 years. He's an iconic figure who many credit with spearheading modernization and economic development in the country. So he abandoned the BN. He joined the opposition because he was shaken by the scale of corruption that had taken up under the watch of Prime Minister Najib Razak, who was ousted last week and is now the first and only Malaysian leader to lose an election. So in these polls, Malaysian voters were upset about two things, mainly rising living costs and corruption. The biggest corruption scandal in the country involves the Sovereign Wealth Fund, 1MDB, which was created and overseen by Najib. So $681 million U.S. dollars from 1MDB were traced to Najib's personal bank accounts in 2015. He admitted to having the money, but he explained it as a gift from the Saudi royal family rather than from Malaysian taxpayers. And it gets crazier. So very few were convinced by this explanation, though Najib has always, you know, denied wrongdoing. So then Najib interfered with the domestic investigations into the scandal. He removed the attorney general. He appointed a new attorney general who cleared him of all charges and closed domestic investigations into 1MDB. And since then, you have a lot of international investigations which are open in the U.S., Switzerland, and Singapore, and other countries where 1MDB funds were laundered through. So currently, the U.S. Department of Justice says that $4.5 billion U.S. dollars were misappropriated from the fund. And that's just the amount of money in the U.S. alone. There's likely more money elsewhere. So Jeff Sessions, he called it kleptocracy at its worst, the U.S. Attorney General. And that money was used to purchase luxury real estate in the U.S., paintings and fine art, you know, Picasso's and Monet's. It was used to purchase jewelry and designer handbags, you know, for Najib's wife. Najib's stepson owns a Hollywood production company, and he used money to finance The Wolf of Wall Street and Dumb and Dumber 2, you know, popular films. So the DOJ has started seizing 1MDB assets already. Now, Najib was not personally named in the findings, which referred to a Malaysian official one. But since then, you know, numerous U.S. and Malaysian officials have confirmed that Najib is that official. Now that he's no longer in office, he may be directly named by the DOJ and charged.
You know, just so we can put this into perspective for our listeners, this would be like Barack Obama switching parties, becoming a Republican, and then running against Donald Trump in order to prosecute him for corruption. It's that monumental, is it not?
It's the biggest shakeup. It's the biggest plot twist. And Anwar's story adds another layer to it. But if I may, I'll just go in real quick about the Malaysian investigations. So the Malaysian government has been going all out to investigate this matter with Mahathir at the helm. He campaigned calling Najib a thief, and he's cleaning house in a big way. In less than a week since he took office, he cracked open the 1MDB audit report, which was sealed under an Official Secrecy Act, and he's opened corruption investigations into Najib's appointed attorney general and other figures. Now, this is really crazy. 2 days after losing the election, Najib and his wife attempted to flee the country on a private jet to Jakarta, but they were barred from foreign travel on Mahathir's orders. And since other top dogs at the fund have been barred from travel as well. And Najib and his wife have since been holed up at their mansion in Kuala Lumpur, as you mentioned at the start of the program. The police conducted a 14-hour search last night and confiscated documents and luxury items. People are expecting he's going to be charged and taken into custody very soon. And the government, having reviewed the 1MDB audit, they say that the wrongdoing was worse than they imagined. And now they're going to be trying to repatriate the funds that are, you know, stuck up in overseas banking systems, which the previous government did not attempt to do at all, which is very fishy because when you have this sort of thing go on, of course, governments want to get their money back. And just real briefly, we'll go into the China factor, just to give a bit more context. So China is linked to 1MDB in some ways, which is one of the reasons why Mahathir had said he would review some of the economic deals clinched with China during Najib's term. So once these whole 1MDB controversies came up, the DOJ opened their probe. Najib had begun to lean very closely to China around 2015. So Malaysia has been one of the largest investment destinations for foreign direct investment, for Belt and Road projects mostly. At the end of 2016, total investments were nearly $300 billion, mostly for mega projects and infrastructure. Now, what Mahathir fears right now and why this whole investigation has taken on such urgency is he fears that in the midst of these deals, that state land and assets were sold off to China at inflated prices and larger loans than were needed were taken, all with the purpose of refinancing 1MDB. Because it's indebted now. The money that the fund took on for all these projects, it went towards corruption and extravagance and all these things. So Mahathir, at the end of the day, is very concerned that Malaysia can be forced into a sovereignty-undermining deal with Beijing if it's unable to service all these debts.
Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan once said that the greatest day in American history was August 9th, 1974. That was the day that Richard Nixon resigned and Gerald Ford became president, and we did not have tanks in the streets, that it was just business as usual around the country. With these momentous changes taking place in Malaysia, do you expect business as usual to continue?
Well, a lot of what's going on in Malaysia now is being juxtaposed with this trend of authoritarianism and a democracy in retreat in Southeast Asia, which is true to a large extent, because you see a lot of governments bringing in repressive policies and whatnot. I do think the new Malaysian government, it's basically a coalition of former rivals. I mean, Mahathir, he was previously the prime minister. He had jailed a lot of the people that are now top leaders in his government. So they have buried the hatchet in a big way. And this is where Anwar comes in. So Anwar was Mahathir's former deputy. He was ousted in 1998 over some economic differences. He was charged with sodomy, which, you know, he was later acquitted of. But this has been ongoing. You know, even when Mahathir left the political scene, Najib tried to jail Anwar, and he did, you know, on sodomy charges, and he was released yesterday. So Anwar is going to take the helm after a year or two, once Mahathir can sort of remedy the situation. And really, I do think if you look at investor confidence, I mean, Malaysia is a very open economy. So there was not many shockwaves in the Malaysian stock market. The Malaysian ringgit, the currency, is not plummeting or anything. So people are confident that the government of the day is going to move forward. I think there is confidence there. And when Anwar steps in, I think he is known to be, he was the finance minister before. He's known to be sort of a prudent manager of affairs and a moderate. So I think this is pretty much a win for Malaysia on that front. And I think people realize the scale and severity of this this corruption campaign and, you know, this corruption incident. And I think if the government gets to the bottom of it, the overall fundamentals bode well for Malaysia.
Niall, I want to go back to the economic question and infrastructure investment for a moment. You know, Malaysia's GDP over the past year or so has been growing between, you know, 5% and 6%, going as high as 6.2% one quarter last year. And for comparison, the U.S. GDP growth has been around 2% in the recent period. You know, I think, of course, there's a consensus that Najib Razak was a deeply corrupt political leader. But of course, some of these infrastructure deals also do have, you know, a legitimately positive effect on Malaysia's economic development. And of course, Malaysia was colonized by the UK for so long. It was, you know, had this enforced underdevelopment. Is there a concern that some of the positive steps towards infrastructure investment might be delayed, or is this sort of a momentary pause while this transition is going on and then Malaysia would resume its relatively rapid growth?
Yeah, I would characterize it as a momentary pause, you know, in the midst of this transition. I think, you know, being in power for 22 years and being, you know, having opened up the doors in a big way to Chinese investment, Mahathir is not an unknown element. I mean, the Chinese know who they're dealing with here. And I think ultimately relations will sort of be not too bumpy with China. But as for the economic climate in Malaysia right now, I'd say Malaysia is going through a challenge economically that many other countries in the region are going through. And that is the fact that high economic growth is not translating. People don't feel like they're benefiting from it. Costs are rising, and it's not trickling down, for lack of a better word. And people don't see the value and the betterment in their own lives in this economic growth. So that's why, I mean, Najib, he campaigned as an economic, you know, as a sound hand and a sound manager of the economy. But at the end of the day, people didn't feel it. So I feel like the new government pretty much has its work cut out for it, you know, going ahead. Najib, he brought in a GST, a 6% sales tax, a goods and services tax that was across the board unpopular. And, you know, with the perception of all this corruption and the very real opulence under his, you know, leadership, people were so disenfranchised with having to pay higher costs and higher taxes. That tax is being rescinded. I mean, it will be rescinded by next week, I believe. So that will be a boon for Mahathir. He is also rolling back some fuel subsidy reforms. So, I mean, people are going to feel it. You know, they're going to feel a little more money in their pocket in the next couple of weeks going ahead.
Certainly an important story here that we're going to continue to cover. We were joined from Singapore by Niall Bowie. He's a writer and journalist with the Asia Times covering Singapore and Malaysia. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned and we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
President Trump and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin will meet with Chinese Vice Premier Liu He to discuss trade. The meetings are meant to prevent trade tensions from spiraling into a trade war, a possibility since the administration imposed sanctions on Chinese goods. We're joined from the UK by John Ross. He was the first non-Chinese citizen to be appointed to a full-time post at a leading think tank in China, Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies, Renmin University of China. He's an award-winning resident columnist with several Chinese media organizations with over 200 articles published on China and the international economy. John, it's always good to have you.
Pleased to speak to you.
John, tell us how important these meetings are. Are they substantive or are they preliminary meetings just to try to smooth the path for future negotiations?
I think by now they will be coming substantive because if they can't, they had seven people from the U.S. in Beijing. They've got the top person, Liu He, on the Chinese economy, who answers really only to President Xi Jinping. And by now, they must be getting into the substance. Whether they will conclude the substance is a different matter. And anyway, of course, President Xi Jinping would have to agree to it. But they will be well into the substance, in my opinion.
And does he have the authority to speak with the administration about North Korea as well?
That would not be within his brief. He's the vice premier. He's in charge of the economy. You cannot tell in negotiations what exactly will come up, but he would not have direct authority to make a position on the question of North Korea. He would have to check back off with Beijing.
John, you know, I was over at CGTN, the Chinese TV, earlier this morning, and obviously this story, in addition to North Korea, but particularly this story of U.S.-China trade, which is also goes in many ways to the core of U.S.-China relations, was at the very centerpiece of the CGTN coverage today. There was, I think, a sort of a sense of, at least in terms of their presentation, a sense of optimism that perhaps some of the very harsh rhetoric and harsh actions by the Trump administration are reversible. And of course, Trump seem to be throwing a lifeline back to ZTE. We say Z in the United States, not Z in the UK. ZTE, a very, very important Chinese company that seemed like it was going to be actually just forced to cease operations because of the draconian economic sanctions and measures imposed by Trump. Anyway, where do you think we are right now?
Well, I think there's three levels of things. Let's leave aside the question, the whole question of the U.S. deficit with China. It's got nothing to do with China. The U.S. trade deficit started to exist in about 1980 and has got progressively worse through the 1990s. In the 1980s, China accounted about 0.5% of world trade. So the deficit has got nothing to do with China and its origins. But there are really three different issues which are different orders of magnitude. First, one which doesn't affect only China is that the U.S. is claiming extraterritorial powers on basically the international financial system. This is hitting Europe as well as hitting the situation in China. That's very, very serious indeed. The second is that the punishment of ZTE is completely disproportionate. The charges that 4 people were dismissed because they violated sanctions, which is the company admitted to, 34 people weren't. And you then have a situation where the United States tries to put the company out of business because if it can't buy the Android operating system and it can't get the processors, then it can't operate. Well, if you put in comparison to this, I mean, look at the people who rigged LIBOR. I mean, this affected probably tens of millions of transactions throughout the world and did vastly greater damage. None of these companies which did on LIBOR were closed down. So this is purely a political move against a major Chinese company. And the all the indications that come out, China is not going to accept that this at all. A similar type of thing is the American attempt to cut off what's called Manufacturing 2025, which is just a perfectly normal program for developing high-tech industry. Germany has something totally similar. These are fundamental issues, which I think are totally core issues for China. Therefore, if it digs in on those, it's going to be very difficult to have any agreement at all. The final part, however, is just the question of whether China, in order to aid its own economic development or other reasons, is prepared to buy more goods from the US or play around a little bit with things of exports. Those matters are negotiable. The decisive matter, I think, that was brought by the Twitter President Trump on the question of ZTE was this appeared to, we have to see the reality, appeared to take off the table the fundamental type of issue on which China can't compromise. That's what I said, the second type of issue. If the negotiations take place around the third issues, that's around imports and exports rather than extraterritorial or disproportionate punishments attempting to put companies out of business, well, then it may be possible to arrive at an agreement. That's why I think that the ZTE tweet by President Trump, caused a shift, because it shifted from matters which really cannot be agreed to in China onto issues on which it may be possible to arrive at agreement.
Right. And of course, this came after, obviously, China was carrying out its own plans, its own measures regarding U.S. agricultural products, in particular soybeans. It wasn't simply a change of heart on the part of the Trump administration. What was China doing as a countermeasure?
Well, China's position has been totally consistent, and its actions have been totally consistent, whereas there seemed to be some not clear what the U.S. administration wants. There seemed to be several positions which come out, and the positions changed quite frequently, as we saw with the tweet on ZTE. The position of China has been very clear. It does not want a trade war with the United States or anybody else, for that matter. On the other hand, if China is attacked, China will defend itself, and it will defend itself in a proportionate fashion. Therefore, when the U.S. announced the $50 billion of goods that were going to be affected by tariffs, China responded immediately by taking $50 billion worth of U.S. goods, of which key ones were soybeans, automobiles, and aviation. That is, China took no action itself, but it responded in exactly proportionate fashion. When President Trump then started to speak about $150 billion, China has got a situation in which it said it will take the comprehensive measures to defend itself. That is its real position. It is not looking for a fight. It doesn't want a fight. It thinks a fight will harm both sides. However, it understands if somebody attacks you, if you don't fight back, I'm afraid they just attack you harder. So therefore, China would respond in a proportionate fashion. Now, I think that message got through to a number of people. I think it got through rather strongly, for example, to U.S. soybean growers. And I think it got through rather strongly to the aviation industry, because there's no technological difference between Airbus and Boeing. And I think that these various groups in the U.S. decided that China's not messing around and would do exactly what it said. And I think, therefore, they also put some considerable pressure on President Trump.
John, I think John is right. John Kiriakou, I think John Ross is right. You could see in the Midwest where, of course, the Senate and the House, especially the House, could go, to the Democrats. People did not, the people who were supporting Trump in these states, who are many of them involved in agriculture, did not expect that Trump's actions would actually start to seriously harm their economic interests.
Well, I think that's a very, very important point in this whole conversation. And that is that a lot of Midwesterners feel cut off from what they believe to be the elites on the West and East coasts. And so they were attracted to a political bomb thrower like Donald Trump. He promised to drain the swamp and make America great again. Well, he also was not used to dealing with foreign governments. He really doesn't think through a lot of policies. He'll make a decision that he announces on Twitter and then just let the cards fall where they may. And this one is set to cost Midwesterners money, especially if they're farming, and even more especially if they're farming soybeans. And so now it's time to back off. And you can bet your next paycheck that it's those Midwesterners who voted for Donald Trump that so want a deal with the Chinese.
And John Ross, we're winding down here, about two minutes left, or 2 minutes plus a few seconds. There's obviously a debate going on within the Trump White House. You have Robert Lighthizer, the trade representative. You have Peter Navarro, who, you know, I think actually wants an open confrontation with China. And then Steven Mnuchin, representing traditional Wall Street interests and banking interests. Anyway, how important is that debate? 1 minute left.
I think it's not terribly important because only one person takes the decisions, President Trump. I think the question of what China's style is, China has a style. China does not make a big noise. China does not go around picking fights with people. And on the other hand, China does what it says. I think some people told President Trump that if it made, he made a big noise, China would back down. And I think China, which responded very quickly, within hours after the first 50 billion, made clear, we will do exactly what we say we're going to do. If you take action against ZTE, we're not really, there's going to be a tremendous fight. If you want to negotiate about how we can improve beef imports and all these types of things, then we can sit down and have a business-like negotiation. That's the Chinese style. It's almost the exact opposite of the one which is to carry out negotiations by Twitter.
John is right. You know, the Chinese are actually good negotiators. Donald Trump, in spite of all of his thing about the art of the deal, he's a lousy negotiator because you never know what his bottom line is, and he keeps switching it. Anyway, this is going to, what happens here with U.S.-China trade will have a very big impact on global politics.
It will indeed. We're out of time. We'll have to leave it there. We were joined from the U.K. by John Ross. John is the first non-Chinese citizen to be appointed to a full-time post at a leading Chinese think tank called Chengyang Institute for Financial Studies, Renmin University of China. He's an award-winning resident columnist with several Chinese media organizations, and he has over 200 articles published on China and the international economy. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A Ukrainian diplomat in Hamburg, Germany, has been suspended for posting virulently anti-Semitic remarks on Facebook. Vasil Marushchinets wrote that Jews were responsible for World War II and ended the post with, quote, death to the anti-fascists, unquote. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko condemned the remarks, but he recently signed into law a measure that glorifies Ukrainians who collaborated with the Nazis. We're joined from London by Alexander Mercouris. He's the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Alexander, good to have you.
Delighted to be with you.
You know, I wanted to tell you also that there's a photo that is accompanying the different variations of this story. It's a photo of this diplomat holding a cake for his 60th birthday, and it's in the shape of a book, and the cover of the book says Mein Kampf.
Oh, my goodness.
What are we supposed to take from this?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about the political views of this particular diplomat. Clearly, he is a man with very strong sympathies for fascist and Nazi views, and probably is a fascist or Nazi. The point to take from it, however, is that the Ukrainian government appoints people of these views to senior diplomatic posts in countries like Germany, and around the world, and that is, of course, of no surprise to anybody who follows the situation in Ukraine at all carefully, because, as you rightly say, President Poroshenko is effectively supporting people in Ukraine who glorify Nazi collaborators who were responsible for fighting against the Allies, against the Russians, and who were heavily involved in the extermination program against the Jews during the Nazi era. So to those who are familiar with the Ukraine, it is no surprise. To those who perhaps are not so familiar, maybe it is a surprise, but it shouldn't be a surprise And the fact that it's been allowed to happen and it's gone so far is, to my mind, a testament to the extraordinary suppression of genuine reporting and real news from the Ukraine, which has been happening in the West ever since the Ukrainian crisis began with the Maidan protests of 2013.
And, you know, this has been going on with this specific diplomat for a long time. And we don't even have the time to get into what other official Ukrainians have been saying or writing or posting. But this individual who is the consul general, the Ukrainian consul general in Hamburg, said on Facebook, in addition to saying death to the anti-fascists, he said, quote, being a fascist is an honor, unquote. And he called the Holocaust a hoax. He said that Jews, Roma, Hungarians, and Russians were second-rate humans that deserved at least a good beating. So it's not like he's been keeping this secret for the past 5 years. He's been very public about it.
Alexander, he represents a strain in Ukrainian politics which has a long history. And we have, like, if we think back, and Americans won't know this because we don't know much about history. Certainly we don't know much even about World War II, even though the United States was a principal force in it. But, you know, when the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union in Operation Barbarossa in June 22nd, 1941, the German divisions came through Ukraine, and not only Ukraine. But by the end of the war, as many as 3 million Ukrainians died, Jews and non-Jews. A huge genocide of Ukrainian people. But during that time, a section of the Ukrainian military and political establishment fought alongside the Nazis, with the Nazis, as willing collaborators in this movement. And some of those same political parties that took power in the overthrow of the corrupt but democratically elected government in February 2014, they look back to those Ukrainians as their real political legacy. Like, that for them is the real Ukraine.
Well, I think you put it exactly correctly. I mean, if I may just say, what you talked about, that this is a strain in Ukrainian politics, as of 2014, it has become the dominant strain. It is the people who are now shaping the narrative of Ukrainian nationhood and Ukrainian statehood. They are the people who say that, who are saying these things. That is why people like this diplomat get appointed at all. It is a ideology which is based upon the ideology of the people who were fascists and Nazi collaborators in Ukraine during the Second World War, and who have never completely gone away. And I think that is something that people in the West need to understand if they are to understand the conflict which is taking place in Ukraine and the conflict which is taking place between the present government of Ukraine and the people of eastern Ukraine, and between the present government of Ukraine and Russia. Because, as you also rightly said, millions of Ukrainians died as a result of what the Nazis did. Tens of millions of Ukrainians resisted the Nazis, many of them fighting in the Red Army, many of them fighting in partisan groups. And, of course, there is a powerful anti-fascist movement in Ukraine and a powerful anti-fascist tradition in Ukraine. And the places which are strongest in resisting the present Ukrainian government in the Donbass, in Odessa, and elsewhere are places which played a very strong and powerful role in the anti-fascist, anti-Nazi struggle of the 1940s as part of the great Second World War, which was fought so bitterly in this part of the world.
You know, I'm amazed, too, that the prime minister of Ukraine, whose name is Volodymyr Groysman, is Jewish. And with all of this sentiment that we read about so frequently, not just among these isolated government officials like the consul in Hamburg, the mayor of this village 60 miles south of Lviv. We hear about it in the Ukrainian parliament. It's debated in our own State Department. And then there's a Jewish prime minister. I don't understand how he's able to even get his job done with all of the anti-Jewish sentiment that we hear about in Ukraine.
Well, to a certain extent, he's not getting his job done. I mean, if you get proper reports from Ukraine, the political situation there is absolutely chaotic, and the governmental situation there is chaotic. That is not, however, because he's Jewish. It is because the political system is so extremely dysfunctional. The reason a person like Groysman has a position of authority in Ukraine is because, though there is a huge amount of anti-Semitic feeling on the part of these people, as has just manifested itself with his diplomat in Hamburg, the overriding priority at the moment for the fascists and Nazis in Ukraine is Russia and fighting Russian influence as they perceive it in Ukraine. So for them, at this moment in time, anti-Semitism, though it is always there and will become stronger in future, is less important for them than it is to fight Russia. How a Jewish man can possibly associate himself with these forces, that, of course, is a very difficult question for me to answer. It is one I think that Mr. Groysman is the only person who can answer, and obviously I don't speak for him.
Let's talk about what's going on in Ukraine in general right now. We have about 2.5 minutes left. There was the Minsk agreements 1 and 2 designed to try to bring an end to the really awful war that was being waged against the people in eastern Ukraine and parts of southern Ukraine. Where are things now?
Well, I think the answer is that they're stuck. The Ukrainian government will never implement the Minsk agreements because for it to do so would be to recognize that the Russian-speaking people of Ukraine have an identity that is different from the Ukrainian-speaking people of Western Ukraine, who are, as far as Ukraine, the present government is concerned, the only Ukrainians. So they will never recognize they will never implement the Minsk agreements. The people in Eastern Ukraine will never accept less, and neither will the Russians. So the conflict there is in effect frozen. The rest of Ukraine, as I said, is in a profoundly dysfunctional state. The economy is not doing well. There's been some talk of revival, but I see little evidence of that. And already now, because of the oil price rise and all sorts of other things, the figures are turning bad again anyway. So we have a situation, a very dysfunctional country, full of angry militant groups, many of them heavily armed because there's been a war, with a culture of violence and a culture of extremism which has taken hold. And I have to say, the prognosis, the future, doesn't look at all good. I don't know how it's going to shape out, where this thing is going to go, but it is difficult to look on the situation in Ukraine at the moment and have anything other than a deep sense of foreboding about it.
We will have to leave it there. We were joined from London by Alexander Mercouris. He is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Senate yesterday passed a non-binding resolution nullifying the Federal Communications Commission's net neutrality rollback. The 52-47 vote is a symbolic blow to the FCC, as the net neutrality repeal remains on track to take effect next month. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garafa. Chris, great to have you.
Brian and John, great to be on. Thanks.
Chris, I don't want to overstate this, but I'm going to say that what we saw with the appointment of Ajit Pai as FCC chairman and his decision to essentially revoke net neutrality is a coup of sorts. It's a policy coup. What you have is a guy who was the general counsel for one of the big telecommunications companies come in and do something that benefits only the big telecommunications companies. This move to repeal net neutrality is going to affect every American in his wallet. And I think most Americans don't understand that. So what we had yesterday was this move in the Senate to express the sentiment that this is a bad policy decision. The shame of it is, and tell me if I'm wrong here, The shame of it is, this was a what's called a sense of the Senate resolution. This was not a bill. This is not something that the president has to veto or sign into law. And indeed, a similar measure has not even been proposed in the House of Representatives. This is just to let the American people know that by a vote of 52 to 47, 52 senators think this is a bad idea. So where do we go from here? Is there really anything that anybody can do to stop the repeal of net neutrality?
So first, I want to back up, John, and actually just make sure that people have an understanding of what net neutrality is, because there's a lot of disinformation out there, and there's also just a lot of confusing information about what net neutrality means. I've certainly seen people's eyes kind of glaze over when they hear about it. Net neutrality is a simple idea that on the internet, your ISPs, the people you pay to get online, can't favor or punish certain traffic or certain destinations on the internet. So they can't favor and give you faster access, for example, to NBCNews.com, but punish, you know, or slow down, Sputnik. And say that, you know, it's going to be slower, or that Sputnik has to pay, for example, to get faster access for their servers. There are so many concerns. It seems like net neutrality is put forward as this like corporate infighting, right? That it's the ISPs, the Comcasts, Verizons, and so forth versus these edge nodes or services like Google, Facebook, and all these other internet services. But really, it's going to affect consumers. It's going to affect everyone, essentially, who uses the internet. Now, yes, there was this 52 to 47 vote yesterday. Actually, this does now need to go to the House and to the president. It was a great victory for net neutrality yesterday to get even this non-binding resolution passed by a pretty narrow margin. People now need to be going and talking to their representatives, urging your representatives to vote yes when this does come to a vote in the House. I think it's actually going to be, it was a tough struggle in the Senate, but it's going to be an even tougher struggle in the House to get any sense of justice on this issue.
I think that's exactly right. And I believe, at least this is my own personal position, that the reason why this is happening and we haven't seen any momentum to stop it is because, number one, people don't fully understand the issue. And number two, even if they understand it, they don't really care. You know, I wonder, too, if from a libertarian point of view, an argument can be made to people who might otherwise be Republicans. Hey, listen, if another Barack Obama type of president is elected, he's going to slow down Fox News and Breitbart, and there's not going to be anything you can do about it. So, you know, maybe it's better for all of us as Americans if we just ditch this whole policy right now and go back to wide open, free net neutrality.
You could certainly make that argument, but I would actually make the argument today that it is going to be alternative news sources outside the mainstream left and right that are actually going to be punished by this the most. We've already seen that Twitter and Google and Facebook are punishing, you know, so-called Russian sources, RT, Sputnik, and others. And the telecoms could go even further. The ISPs could go further than that and actually punish them by slowing down access or even blocking access entirely to their websites and podcasts and services. And I think that's an issue that even today, not even halfway into a Trump presidency, with a Democratic Party assault on Russia and people, you know, accused of being Russian bots, that we need to address today and not just, you know, in a future potential Democratic administration.
Let's talk, Chris, about what the people arguing for this new policy would advocate. It seems on its face so obvious that right now you have an open internet and companies can't favor, based on money, some entities over others. Those entities can set up paywalls, like if you want to read the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times or the Washington Post, they can create a paywall so that you have to subscribe to that periodical or to that website. But right now, it's not about whether you get to a site faster or slower. It's just whether or not you've paid for access to that site. And then there are many, many, many other sites that there is no paywall. People can just go to them and get information. What's the argument that those forces within corporate America who will benefit the most from this, what are they saying to the public? And then let's just talk about the validity of their argument.
Sure. So in the decision last year by the FCC to roll back the 2015 open Internet order, and that kind of codified net neutrality, in the decision last year, the FCC said it was, quote, against the, quote, heavy-handed utility-style regulation of the Internet, that effectively it was getting in the way of even greater profits for the media companies and the ISPs that they partner with. That's their argument, is that it's getting in the way of profit, effectively.
Okay, so fine. So what? I mean, why is that a winning argument for the masses of people?
That's right.
I mean, how does it possibly benefit the public?
Because the flip side is very clear. It doesn't benefit the public. This is going to cost the public money in the long run. Whether they like it or not, it's going to cost them money. Never mind the issue of whether or not a future president is going to slow down sites that they like. This is just going to make it more expensive for everybody to access the Internet.
Well, the companies will decide, right, Chris? The companies will decide what entities have a favored status and which ones don't have a favored status. So it's no, like right now, I can go anywhere I want on the Internet, and depending on the nature of my service, I'm going to get to any of these sites in the same amount of time. But if the big corporations that sort of become the gatekeepers for the Internet say, well, you know what, if you want to get to New York Times, you have to pay you have to pay more. Or if you want to get to something else, you have to pay more. Why shouldn't this argument be so easily won with the broad public? Maybe the term net neutrality is too, I don't know, it doesn't sound the alarm as much as like actually having internet freedom, which is what's going to be limited now.
Right. I actually do like the idea of calling it internet freedom. And we need to really look at this also as a media consolidation issue as well. Because of the way that the monopolies work in the internet access and media landscape. So Comcast owns NBC. So what if you use Comcast to get online and then you are all of a sudden you can't get to another news provider, or it's so much slower to get to another news provider's website because Comcast is prioritizing NBC. You know, something more direct to people's concerns. Let's say Comcast decides they want to slow down access to Netflix because they have a competing internet service. I think that is something that we need to talk about that people will definitely be concerned about. How many people watch Netflix, on a daily basis? If the companies that are partnered with Hulu wanted to block access to Netflix or vice versa, that's certainly something that they could do. And we should say that right now, all of these corporate entities, the ISPs, are saying, oh, we have no plans to change anything. We have no plans. They're putting these public statements out. But at the same time, particularly Verizon, their CEO is going to their shareholders and saying, we are seeing this as a way to make even greater profit for our shareholders, which then means greater profit for the board, for the CEOs and the high executives. So while they're trying to reassure people, everyday people, that they're not going to change anything, they clearly have plans to take advantage of this rollback.
And that is exactly what we should be worried about. I'm heartened that the U.S. Senate took the initiative to pass a resolution. Usually the resolutions that they pass are to commemorate, you know, Polish Independence Day and National Boy Scout Appreciation Week or whatever. Those are usually what you see in terms of these Senate resolutions. This was an important one. This was one that served to educate people and to highlight this issue as something that's really important. It was a non-binding resolution, but at least it was an attempt to keep this in the news. We will come back to this. This issue's not over. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. You can also now hear us at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.